Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 32. This is the second episode in a series of episodes about the grassy knoll and all the mystery that encompasses that topic. In the first episode in this series, we set the stage for the discussion and we introduced you to Mary Woodward, the Cub reporter from the Dallas Morning News, who, through her real-time article appearing on Saturday morning, the day after the assassination, and the circumstances that were developing that day in Dallas, added to the idea of a conspiracy after the fuse was lit by a UPI dispatch sent by Merriman Smith some 25 minutes after the shots were fired. Today, we begin to move into a more meatier discussion from the witnesses themselves and tell the story, as I usually do, from official testimony that these witnesses gave. In the next episode, episode 33, we'll begin to hear audio from actual eyewitnesses, and much of that is because many of these witnesses were not interviewed by the Warren Commission. That shouldn't be a surprise, given what we know about the official narrative that evolved quickly. Ironically, that void by the authorities gives us a gift of being able to hear these incredible stories without government intervention of the witness, and with some of them told very close to real time, right around the assassination, and then still others taken in the 1964 through 1966 timeframe. But before we go there, in today's episode, episode 32, we are going to hear about the mysterious appearance of Secret Service agents in highly dubious physical locations just moments after the shooting. These were not all necessarily men in black, but they were all seemingly nefarious characters. But let's see what you think as a member of the jury. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 32. Vantage point. Perspective. Think about the witnesses that you have listened to and heard from so far. Think about where they were stationed physically during this dramatic passion play. Each of those witnesses had a unique view from the vantage point they occupied, but they could only see what they could see. If you were in the depository and you were looking down Elm Street, it was one view and one view only. If you were at the Triple Underpass, it was a completely different view with different parts of the plaza visible, parts that would not be visible to people in other locations. That was true for everyone. And this corollary may seem obvious, but we have to keep that in mind every time we're talking about a group of witnesses that were seeing things from a certain vantage point. In fact, it's more than relevant for this set of episodes because now, at this point, the action is exploding everywhere on the plaza, and people all over the plaza from each of their vantage points saw something unique, and in many cases, essential to understanding what happened. But like a puzzle, the pieces need to be connected before they form a true picture of what happened that day. Let's start with the charge up the grassy knoll. It was really only seconds after the motorcade sped away in its mad dash to Parkland Hospital before the stunned crowd began to move forward en masse, charging up that knoll. Charging because they thought something had happened that had been initiated somewhere up there, either on the knoll itself or behind the picket fence. That something was likely to be that shots had been fired from there. Whether it was their ears playing tricks on them because of the acoustics in Dealey Plaza, or whether it was real. At that moment, there was nothing but an instinctual personal response to what they had witnessed and what their eyes and ears and mind had just seen and processed. And once a few began to charge, the few became many. Now, whether each and every one of them had the same auditory and cranial reactions that culminated in the need to charge up that hill, well, we don't know. Some just began charging because others began charging first. They followed as one more human reaction, a reaction to those individuals who had actually already been called up that hill by their own senses. The moment this action started to happen, some of the most mysterious things began to arise and be seen. This new vantage point up on the hill and behind the fence now created a new set of vantage points and interactions that became witness events. Perhaps the most serious evidence of sinister goings-on became evident almost immediately. Joe Marshall Smith was a policeman in the Dallas Police Department. He was an 8-year veteran who had spent the first 3.5 years in radio patrol and then transferred to the traffic division, where he was presently working at the time of the assassination. He was assigned the traffic duty at the corner of Elm and Houston, and he got there around 9 a.m. on the day of the assassination. He had gotten instructions from Captain P.W. Lawrence basically to hold traffic up as the motorcade came through that day and to assist in the crowd control prior and during the time that the motorcade passed through Dealey Plaza, and also to be specifically on the lookout for anyone throwing anything from the crowd. As specific as those instructions were, Smith couldn't remember if his instructions had included a request to scan the buildings above and around him in the plaza. The morning was routine, and nothing momentous occurred until just minutes before the motorcade was due to arrive. And then an event took place that we already know about all too well from our previous episodes. A man suffered an epileptic fit, which required attention, and Officer Smith gave service. He would recall that just after they got the epileptic seizure victim in the ambulance and had him en route to the hospital, it would then be only a few minutes after that that Officer Smith would have to get back to the corner, really just in time to begin directing traffic again before the motorcade was to arrive. And his estimate, just 3 minutes or so before the presidential motorcade began to appear at Houston and Main. As instructed, Officer Smith began holding traffic up at the school book depository. Occupied with traffic matters, he would have his back turned to the depository and would miss any view of what was happening right then up in the windows. There was no chance to actually scan the building, even if he had wanted to. And then he heard the shots, and as soon as he heard them, he started in the direction of the book depository. He didn't know where the shots had come from, but it sounded to Officer Smith like there was a ricochet and a definite echo related to the shots. As he began to approach the area around the depository, a woman came up to Officer Smith. She was in hysterics, and she said to him, "They are shooting the president from the bushes." So Smith turned and dashed toward that area, the area that she had indicated, which is up on the grassy knoll, and he proceeded to the spot that was immediately behind the concrete structure. Smith would quickly check all the bushes that the woman had pointed to, and eventually he would enter the parking lot and railroad yard that lay on the other side. He pressed on, and by that time, he wasn't alone. He had been joined by a deputy sheriff, which was likely Roger Craig, and Smith tells the story that there was one other law enforcement person there. One Secret Service man. One Secret Service man when he got there. As he entered the parking lot, he had pulled his service revolver, mindful of the statement that the hysterical woman had just made, that the shooter just might be right up there. As he charged into the parking area, already standing there was this man. And this man, probably because Officer Smith was charging up toward him with his revolver pulled and in full view, felt it necessary to show his credentials. This man would show Officer Smith credentials that he was a Secret Service agent. In the awful hysteria that was the aftermath, well, that was good enough for Officer Smith at that moment, and he continued on to begin the search of the area. He began checking in between all the cars in the parking lot. This was, of course, the lot that was behind the grassy knoll and the picket fence and adjacent to the railroad yard. Visually looking inside each car and all around each car in the sea of cars parked in that general area. Finally, to his satisfaction, he concluded that no one was hiding overtly amongst the cars, although in his testimony, he would clarify that he didn't try to enter any car, and presumably that meant that he did not check any of the car trunks. Systematically, he would move his way from where he had initially started, which was closer to the depository, and eventually make his way west down toward the railroad tracks where they traverse the Triple Underpass. As he completed this task as quickly as he could, Smith found nothing. Smith would encounter two other officers there in that area where the parked cars were. Sadly, in his testimony, he was not asked and he did not offer to try and identify these two men by name or even if he had recognized them as known officers. So we're not sure whether he knew them or not, or just assumed they were officers based on what they were wearing. I say this to you, the jury, because of matters you'll hear later in testimony about certain uniformed policemen in the area. Officer Smith spent probably 15 to 20 minutes up in that parking lot searching for anything that might be a clue to what had happened. By this time, there was a swarm of policemen nearby in the plaza. As I mentioned, Smith, at this point, had already encountered a plain-clothed Dallas deputy sheriff, and it was probably Roger Craig. Roger had already run into Arnold Roland, and you have heard that story in earlier episodes. And Roger, at some point, relayed to Officer Smith what Arnold Roland had seen and the story that he had heard from Roland, essentially conveying that shots had come from the school book depository, and that the police were in the process of sealing off access to that building. So Officer Smith hurried over toward the depository with another officer, Officer Barnett. And as they approached the vicinity of the front door of the depository, Deputy Chief Lumpkin gave them both orders to stay there and seal off the entrance to the depository. Officer Smith's guarding of the front door commenced around 1 o'clock or sometime shortly thereafter, and Smith would stay there until about 2:30. Now, let's pause and ask, what's wrong with that picture? Well, to most folks, nothing may be overtly wrong. But here is the deal. There were no Secret Service agents in that area that day. All of the Secret Service agents on detail were fully accounted for in other locations. It was not possible for a Secret Service agent to have been there. This man that Officer Smith would encounter, this man that showed credentials that he was a Secret Service man, this man was an imposter. In his testimony to the Warren Commission, Smith would lament it. His instincts told him something was off as he encountered this man, but apparently the quest to find a more obvious assassin overtook the senses. Perhaps somebody with a gun in his hand wearing a t-shirt that said, "I just shot the president"? Well, I'm just saying. And in all seriousness, Smith was a traffic cop, and the level of coordination was minimal between the different agencies. He wasn't aware of who or how many agents from other federal authorities were going to be there in the plaza. In a perfect world, he should have known. In the world of the 1960s and the Dallas of the 1960s, it just didn't happen that way. Smith would later state that he hadn't been more diligent with this man, this mystery man that represented himself as a Secret Service agent. Smith would tell the Warren Commission, in his own words, "He looked like an auto mechanic. He had on a sports shirt and sports pants, but he had dirty fingernails. It looked like, hands that looked like an auto mechanic's hands. And afterwards, it didn't ring true for the Secret Service. At the time, we were so pressed for time, and we were searching, and he had produced correct identification, and we just overlooked the thing. I should have checked that man closer. But at the time, I didn't snap on it." Years later, after he was no longer the Dallas police chief, Jesse Curry would state in 1977 that the man encountered by Officer Smith must have been bogus. That is a strong statement coming from the chief of police at the time. Someone who was there on the scene and even gave the order to get men up there in that area around the grassy knoll just after the moment when the shots rang out. Another thing we know, not only were there no Secret Service agents stationed on or behind the grassy knoll that day, but there were no FBI or other federal agents stationed there either. Not at that moment, anyway. And Officer Smith was not the only witness who encountered an apparently phony federal agent. But before we go on to hear more about other phony agents, let's do an inventory of Secret Service agents that day. Sylvia Maurer, the famous assassination researcher, has already done that for us. In her famous 1960s masterpiece, Accessories After the Fact. Basically, there were two batches of Secret Service agents that day. The ones in Dallas that came as part of the White House detail that were with the president on his visit. And six other Secret Service agents, field agents, stationed locally there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. These agents were headed up by Forrest Sorrells, an agent that you have already been introduced to in prior episodes. The whereabouts of the White House Secret Service agents that came with the entourage are accounted for in Commission Exhibit 1024. They stayed with the presidential party the entire day that day, returning to Washington with the new president on Friday, along with the rest of the entourage. Some of those agents had been stationed at the Trademark where Kennedy was to have spoken at lunch, and some of those agents remained located at Love Field. These two details of men of Washington Secret Service agents after the shooting either went to Parkland Hospital or maintained their posts until the plane departed back to Washington, but they were not in Dealey Plaza that day. Not one agent from the Washington-based Secret Service contingent went to Dealey Plaza or anywhere near the book depository that day. There is also evidence as well that none of the Secret Service agents from the Dallas field office were in Dealey Plaza that day at the time of the shooting. Headed by Forrest Sorrells, the office was staffed with six agents, including Mike Howard, who was actually stationed in Fort Worth. Of the remaining five, two men, J.J. Howlett and Robert Stewart, were assigned to the Trademark. Two more, William Patterson and Roger Warner, were assigned to Love Field. The remaining officer, the sixth agent, was Elmer Moore, and he was not assigned the task of being part of the presidential protection during the president's visit in Dallas, so he did not file a report. Presumably, he was off duty or attending to other duties that day. Forrest Sorrells would return to the scene, but it would be some 20 minutes later, after all of this immediate activity that took place up past the grassy knoll within minutes of the shooting. Thrilling. No, chilling, isn't it? Let's pivot now to two other important witnesses, two other key law enforcement officers who gave sworn testimony that they immediately ran into Secret Service agents as they rushed the area behind the picket fence and also close to the school book depository. Our next witness is Seymour Weitzman. You know him from a previous episode when we introduced Roger Craig. Weitzman was a deputy constable that ended up on the sixth floor of the depository minutes after Roger Craig and Eugene Boone discovered the rifle, and he would be part of the team that filed formal reports on the discovery of the gun. Formal reports, by the way, that said it was a 7.65 German Mauser and not a Mannlicher Carcano. That was an awkward moment at the commission hearing when he had to explain that error. But at this moment, Weitzman was among the first of the law enforcement officers to make their way to the area behind the grassy knoll and to begin searching for clues to what happened. He, too, was there because he thought the shots came from that area. Weitzman is an interesting individual. He served in the Air Force during World War II. He was shot down and he became a prisoner of war in Japan. He was a pilot, a flying sergeant. He was an educated man with an engineering degree that he finished up after he was back in the States and discharged, right at the end of World War II. but he decided to go into business, and he went into the business of ladies' garments, later working for Holly's dress shops in New York City. He would be a district supervisor for them for 15 years before he would eventually make his way back to Galveston as the general manager of the Lamont Corp. In 1960, he closed up all the stores and retired from that business and went to work for Robbie Love in the Dallas Sheriff's Office. Like many of the Sheriff's Office employees that day, he was simply out in front of the Sheriff's Office at Main and Houston watching the parade. He would hear three distinct shots, one shot and then a pause, and then the second two to him seemed to be almost simultaneous. He would be pressed into action by the events. Instinctively, he began to run toward the president's car, even though he knew it was already on Elm Street. As he got closer, he would run down that little street that runs off of Elm close to the monument and begin scaling the wall. In the rush to get over the wall, he apparently grabbed what he later thought was steam pipes because he burned his hands. Nevertheless, he pushed on and made his way into the railroad yard, and there he would encounter other officers, including, as he would describe it, other Secret Service agents as well. One of the first things that he saw was numerous kinds of footprints that, in his mind, did not make any sense. They were going in all directions. You see, it had been raining that morning in Dallas, and the ground was still soft and wet in spots, so footprints were easy to capture that morning. As he was working the scene, he went back over the wall as someone had seen something red in the road, and then someone approached him with what they believed to be part of a firecracker, which seems kind of odd when you hear what comes next. Weitzman thought it looked more like a piece of bone, but he knew it needed to go to the lab, so he turned it over to one of the Secret Service men. Weitzman would later find out that, indeed, it was a bone fragment from the president's skull. He would state that the fragment was found on the south side of the street, but on the street itself, on the pavement, maybe 8 to 12 inches from the curb, or something like that. As part of this exchange, he had talked with a railroad yard man and asked him if he had seen or heard anything during the passing of the president. This yard man had seen something, and it was significant. The yard man told Constable Weitzman that he saw somebody throw something through a bush. That is what prompted Weitzman to go looking and what prompted, eventually, the discovery of the skull fragment. The yard man apparently directed Weitzman to where this activity had occurred, pointing out the wall section where the bunch of shrubbery was, and it was, as Weitzman believed, near that section of the wall that he had just scaled and gone over, and where he had burned himself on the steam pipe. Well, that section was just to the right of where the yard man had been pointing. Sadly, we know nothing more about who this yard man is or what more he actually saw. No more testimony was taken of Constable Weitzman on the topic. The Warren Commission attorney immediately steered away from the topic. They went this far and then ended his interview without any more discussion of it. Not surprising, really. Here he is recalling the existence of Secret Service agents in the area immediately after the shots were fired, and then finally a railroad yard man indicating that the yard man saw a man toss something in the bushes, bushes that were located in the vicinity of the knoll and the picket fence. Keep this last item in mind when we hear the story of Ed Hoffman later in this series of episodes. Rather quickly, he and the other officers would make their way to the depository. Let's pause there. Again, now we have a second, highly reputable member of the Sheriff's Department hierarchy, a deputy constable, stating that there were Secret Service agents on site, and apparently in no hurry to leave immediately, as they remained to have at least one conversation with him as he discovered the skull fragment. They were right there in the parking lot behind the grassy knoll, and we are clear that there could not have been any Secret Service agents there officially. Now, the one hanging chad is that he seemed to have given the fragment to one of them, and it made its way to a lab, presumably. That was not the action of a bogus agent, if that part of the story is true. Now, on the other hand, there were other fragments gathered that day, and the constable may just have been making a generic statement about what those fragments all turned out to be. That's different than the idea that one fragment was actually sent to the lab for analysis by the particular agent he encountered. You see, all sorts of questions that should have been asked never were. Next, let's turn to another law enforcement officer, D.V. Harkness. In some ways, this next one starts to get even more bizarre. Harkness was a 42-year-old sergeant with the Dallas Police Department who was a 17-year veteran. He had gone into the Coast Guard during World War II, and he was a boatswain on a troop transport vessel. That day, on the 22nd, he was supervising the traffic officers along the parade route. At 12:30 precisely, when the shots occurred, he was also at Houston and Main, riding his three-wheeler. But for a moment, he had dismounted the cycle and stood at the corner so that he could see the parade go by. He would walk on foot, heading west of Main, until he made it to the opening in the middle of Dealey Plaza. There, he would have a good view of the last leg of the motorcade as they finished up the downtown segment and headed to the trademark. Officer Harkness heard the first shot and immediately began to make his way back to Main and Houston, where he had parked his motorcycle, and suddenly the second and third shots rang out. He was unable to tell from what direction they were coming from, but as he began to ride his motorcycle west on Main, something, including the way people were hitting the ground, led he and others to indicate that the shots were coming into the car from somewhere in front of the car. He would continue west past the Triple Underpass all the way down to Industrial, which is a street west of the Triple Underpass, to see if he could see anything, anyone, fleeing the area. But he found nothing, and so he immediately turned around and came back to the book depository. He would make his way near the side extension of Elm next to the depository, where he would then almost immediately run into Amos Lee Ewens, who would tell Officer Harkness that the shots had come from inside the depository building. I'll skip what came next as he delivered Amos to Inspector Sawyer on his three-wheel motorcycle, as you have heard all of that in another episode on Amos. Harkness would make his way to the rear of the depository in an effort to seal off the rear exits. He would stay there until a squad arrived. Only what he found when he got to the rear of the depository was that he wasn't the first to arrive at the party. In his Warren Commission testimony, Harkness would state that when he arrived at the back of the school book depository building, there were Secret Service agents there already. He didn't ask for identification, but he stated that the men themselves told him that they were Secret Service agents. Okay, let's pause right here for a moment. Now we have heard the third member of law enforcement make statements that immediately after the shooting, they encountered Secret Service agents in highly suspicious locations, first behind the picket fence, in the parking lot of the railroad yard, and now in the rear of the school book depository. All three of these men were interviewed by the Warren Commission attorneys under oath at the time these statements were made. And yet the commission attorneys pivoted away each time from pursuing any additional information on these topics. In the now familiar pivot away from the topic move, leaving the answer of what this could be totally unanswered, totally unexplored. Hoping it would be a dog that they could just leave there, you know, just lying on the floor in broad daylight. But wait, there is even more to the Harkness testimony. Once Harkness was relieved at the rear of the depository by the squad that showed up to guard the rear entrance, he would then return to the front of the depository, first helping for a moment to get the crowd under control, and then getting further direction from Inspector Sawyer. Sawyer now directed him to go back to the railroad yard and search all freight railroad cars that were set to leave. He would head to the yard, identify a long freight train, and search it. Finding some people inside of a car, and pulling them out. Later, during testimony, he would describe them as tramps and hobos. Or rather, the Warren Commission attorney would do that, and he would just agree with that characterization. They would search a second long freight car, and out of the entire search, they would find more suspicious people, and they would make arrests. All of the suspects were taken to the police station. No guns were found in the course of picking these people up, though. Well, there you have it. The Dallas police rounded up a handful of suspicious people, found them hiding in a set of boxcars right behind the depository in the grassy knoll, basically along a logical escape route, right after the assassination, and then charged them. And the Warren Commission was truly uninterested in hearing anything more about them or their disposition, characterizing them as tramps and hobos. And that was all that was needed to, once again, give the commission a plausible excuse as to why they failed to ask any more relevant questions. No more questions at all related to this suspicious group of people arrested by Officer D.V. Harkness and others. These quote-unquote tramps are now part of JFK assassination conspiracy folklore, particularly because a number of them were coiffed and wearing nice shoes and had other characteristics that made it hard to believe that they were characterized as tramps or hobos. Well, before I get off on another wander, this subject deserves a separate episode, so I won't elaborate any more here as there is much to tell and discuss about this matter. But as I told you at the beginning of this series, we were going to see the commission take their investigative failures to new heights. Failures when it comes to avoiding the examination of key facts, circumstances, and witnesses. And this was all done in broad daylight. They published it all, for God's sake. Hard to believe. As the old saying goes, only in America. Thank you for listening to episode 32 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.